So tell me what you're trying to get out of this interview thing.
Out of this podcast. All right. Well, I don't know. I was sitting at work the other day, kind of bored, eating lunch, eating some Greek yogurt, and I was listening to the Marc Maron interview with Obama. And then, as good an interview as that was, I started thinking more like, dude, I spent all my free time watching interviews. Like, I'm listening to NPR podcasts at work. Come home, I watch Mac DeMarco interviews on YouTube. Like, I just think interviews are really cool. Medium, they're good content. People say interesting things in interviews, and then it got me thinking, like, I'm not really having good conversations with people some of the time. Like, a lot of the time, I'm just talking about myself, which I guess I'm doing right now. And then I'm always just cracking jokes, and I kind of want to hear what people have to say. And then I started thinking that this could be something cool at school that I could do, because no one's really doing it, and that'd be just kind of an interesting hobby. And then I got into that whole cycle of thinking where, like, man, I always have these ideas. Like, I'm always trying to make a movie, or I'm always trying to record music, and I never do. And this is a lot easier than that. It's just recording conversations I'm having with people. So I have no real excuse not to do it. And now we're here. I just feel like even if no one listens to it, it'll be kind of just like fun and a good idea to just like record conversations.
It's about the process.
It's about the process. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like, getting other people to start talking about their lives. It'll strengthen my connections with people. I thought I'd have you, I'd have to talk to you about it first just because I feel like we already kind of talk a lot, and like we're pretty close, and so this is pretty stupid. We can just kind of like, shut the laptop and forget about it. Whereas if I just like hit up someone kind of random, like it wouldn't necessarily go very well. So I don't know. I don't really have a script or anything. We already kind of had some pretty good conversations that were lost
off mic, man.
Off the mic, raw. I don't know. I was just getting off to the thought of like, all right, Will Schweller podcast. Like, this is the thing he does. Like, he's notorious for, he'll buy you whatever you want at the Bowdoin Cafe. You go meet him in the library study room, and you talk for now. You get good content down. So I was just kind of vibing on that. I don't know.
It'd be cool if you could like talk to like professors and stuff.
Right. Well, that's kind of like the idea. That's why I wanted to start now, and like have maybe like two or three recorded things down, just so that I could have a little confidence in asking people. Like, I'd love to talk to you, like a professor, and like get more of a broad range of people than just like my friends.
Yeah, I think it'd be cool to like just like get people like, that like Humans in New York thing.
Yeah, that was like part of my inspiration. Like a couple guys, I think it was like my freshman year, maybe it was like first semester sophomore year, made like Humans of Bowdoin, and like it was cool because you got to see like, oh, I know who this person is, and like I've spoken to them in a class setting, but here's like a paragraph about their life.
Right.
And I was like, that's really cool. And I think this is more of like a long form.
I like how it's like with those things, it's just like sometimes it's like someone telling like their life story, like, oh, like I came from the Dominican Republic on like a steamship. I had to paddle myself the last mile. And like it's like something like really crazy. And then like that was like very generalizing. And other times it's just like it's them just like saying like what happened to them this morning. And I think that's just really cool. Like that kind of like that's like shorter, but just like something like,
yeah.
That you tell one little story or one little moment, and it's like a reflection of like a bigger idea or the person themselves.
Yeah, and like you're happy that you've read that little post.
Yeah.
And like hopefully people will be happy that they listen to this. And like I'm sure the guy who does Humans in New York is like, well, that was like a very valuable short little story you told me. And the person who said it's like, I'm really happy I was able to express that. So I feel like there's just nothing bad. Like it just produces good.
Yeah, I feel like it kind of reminds you. The moth storytelling thing? Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah. I don't know.
People love to talk about themselves, and it's kind of cool. Like, even if this conversation we're having now ends up to be the most, like, boring and mundane.
But, yeah, thing. I mean, it could just teach you how to, because, I mean, like, I'm definitely talking with, like, a little bit of a different cadence knowing that I'm being recorded. But, like.
Me too. You gotta know. You already know I'm talking a little differently. I'm just trying to sound a little bit more learned and Terry Gross-esque.
Yeah, but just like I feel like you could just by doing this a couple times, you could learn how to condense it down into like how to talk and like how to make it like free flowing. Like maybe you talk off mic for something like okay, and then you do like a lead in like this is X this person and we're gonna talk about like the like why this book is important to them, and like, or like why we both like this book, or like something like whatever small thing,
right?
And it's like, and then I think
just see where it goes. Like I'm trying to get a sense of like what to say, like what little pointed things to throw in to like stimulate someone talking. Because I don't know. I'd like this to be, like, definitely, like, people I'm talking more of it. And, like, this is less me just using a soapbox.
Right. I feel like you should just, like, be, like, tell us something interesting that's about you or that's happening to you. And then just, like, go off that format. And then I feel like you get something kind of interesting.
Jack, tell me and, you know, the two listeners that I'll ever get in my whole life. Tell us something interesting that's happened to you, or like something. What are you vibing on that's important to you right now?
Excuse me.
Like you can be talking about the Ann Coulter anger, the Sean Hannity anger we were just expressing, or I mean you can talk about like cycling, good donut you had the other day.
The one thing that I was thinking about when you hit me up about this was that talking about the cycling is that I race. Cycling competitively, you know, essentially it's the highest level of amateur competition, you know, pretty much as high as you can get without being paid. And so there's kind of like a little, it's kind of, you know, I'm kind of at a fork in the road with it where it's, you know, I could double down and try to commit everything to it, or I could be pretty comfortable where I am, you know, and enjoy, you know, being successful at, like, you know, the local regional level of racing, or right now I'm trying to push towards, you know, laying it all out there and hit the big national races. But the kind of interesting thing about cycling is it's all number based, and so you have your power, which is measured with a device. There's a bunch of different kinds, but most cyclists who train heavily have some kind that measures the force from their body to the pedals, and then you take that number and then you divide it by the weight of the rider, and then that's the power to weight for a given time period. So, you know, you could say if I could push 400 watts for 5 minutes, or I could push 350 watts for 20 minutes, then you could derive your threshold ability and your lactic, which is your lactic threshold, and that's a measure of fitness. So even though racing is so much about like the nuance of it, there's like these numbers that are like very cut and dry of like, this is what your fitness is. And so it becomes getting those power numbers up and getting the weight down is the route to being faster. And it's even more about the numbers, because what made me think about this is this morning I was part of a research study that involved VO2 max testing. And VO2 max is essentially your body's ability to carry oxygen. And you could raise it a little bit, but, well, you could raise it a lot. But if you're born with a really good one, you're going to be pretty good at endurance sports. And if you're not born with a very good one, you're going to struggle with endurance sports. So there's kind of like, there's kind of a battle of philosophies in the sport. Like, can you, like, is there a ceiling to one's ability? Like, can you hit your natural ability ceiling? Is it willpower? Is it natural ability? Like, obviously some people, when they first start riding, they're going to be at different levels. But even if you start as like a real good cyclist, maybe you don't have the capacity to train, and the person who started off not so good can learn how to train and learn how to push themselves harder and can eventually become faster. So it's like, it's a real tough kind of thing, because, you know, when I get that number, that VO2 number, it's like, it's pretty much saying, for an example, mine's like 75. It's like milliliters of oxygen over like kilos of weight. There's a whole formula for it, but the, you know, Tour de France winners are between the high 80s, low 90s. Cross-country skiers will go a little bit higher because they use their arms and legs when competing. Right. And so just seeing that number, like, you know, mine's 75 and it's not Tour de France. And it's like, is this as high as I can go? Like, how much more can I push? Can I push my body into the 80s? Can I just turn myself inside out, you know? Will my body naturally get faster? It's like really hard, because it's like, you know, this is what, you know, I want to live the dream and race professionally, or, you know.
But
you're getting hit with these numbers that are telling you that's just not gonna happen.
It's but not like, that it's I not mean, gonna happen, but it's just that I'm below the most naturally able people. But then you hear about people who have these really low VO2 scores and they can just grit their teeth and go hard.
True.
And that's like a talent in and of itself.
Yeah.
So that's just one interesting thing that it's like, it's this, I mean, it's not as much, I think, as running or triathlon is just about like crunching numbers, but it's a lot of it as far as the fitness of it is just like these numbers that might not be able to be changed that much. And I've always been of the opinion that if you just learn to train harder, you can get much faster than you think you can. Because I think a lot of people subscribe themselves in the amateur level. They say, "Oh, I can't get that much faster." Like,
because so don't, yeah.
Yeah, and they just get comfortable where they are, and it's like when I started. Like, I mean, I was young, but it's like I was racing against kids just as old as me, and they would smoke me. And then I was just like, well, if I just keep riding, like, I'll eventually get better than them. And then I'm like, at this point, I have.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. I think what's kind of scary about cycling is, like, just from, like, the sense I've gotten from you, I mean, I obviously know tremendously little compared to you. But, and I guess this is true with, like, a lot of sports and stuff, is, like, there's only so many races in a year, and you're only going to be theoretically competitive for, like, you know, like X number of years of your life. So, like, you got to really, like, do well when you can. And, like, you may have these really high numbers and you may be, like, statistically fast. But, like, you know, any given Sunday kind of theory, like, you just have a bad race and then that just, like.
Absolutely. And it's hard.
That's really frightening.
Because we travel to these races and we're trying to make an impact. And, like, and the thing is, like, you really just got to, the race I do the best at is what I approach it as. I'm going to race the best and I'm not concerned about the result or the numbers or anything. I just want to get done and feel like I left it all out there and I had quality race craft.
Yeah.
And that's when I typically do the best. But yeah, that's it's really funny because, you know, in the course of, you know, the 8 month season or 7 month season, depending on where you live, the typical rider, I mean, to a degree, you might have a handful of days that you're riding for the whole day, the whole year. You know, those big result days or those days when you're pedaling and you're just weightless and no one's stopping you. And you only get a couple a year, but it makes it all worth it, those few days when you could just ride away from everyone else. And I mean, my teammates and I will joke about it, but there's like, you only get a few, and then the rest of it, you're just hoping that it's the time to come. But yeah, that's kind of how it goes.
I don't know. I'm definitely the kind of person that would just psych me out. I would just feel like I could train as hard as possible. I could be statistically, numerically the best that I could be and still like just brick it. I don't know. That would psych me out. I feel like that's also, you know, a large part of why I'm not competing at anything at the top tier level.
Yeah, that's like the crazy thing is because, and like, so, and I've learned like what races will wig me out and what won't. But it's hard because I've gone to some races and I've been like, this is it. Like, this is like, I should do really well here. And by and large, I've never really performed well at those races, but it's really hard because you have that one day in front of you and you're like, I've got to do well. And, you know, I have a lot of friends out at the national championship for amateurs right now, which I didn't go to because it was all the way in Tahoe, but it was at altitude, so you had to go out early to acclimate.
Yeah.
And there's all these guys and they're putting it all into being out there. And flying out there and staying out there, and it's like it's one race, and I just know, like, you know, I could probably figure it out to get the flight out there and line the schedule up, but it's like it's one race, the road race. That's the one that really matters, and you get one flat tire, and it's over. Whereas I could go to a big Midwest weekend, and you know, and part of that is I know I wouldn't be competitive at nationals with those guys, but you know. maybe if I go to the bigger Midwest events where I can do three races in a weekend and one race I have a good performance at and make marks with the right people, that could be important for where I go later in the sport. But it's like statistically, like you take such a gamble when you go to those races.
I think it's very cool that you've like dedicated so much time. When did you start riding? Like with any competitiveness? Like when were you racing for?
When I was 14 was when I got my first license.
Okay.
Like racing license. So you get you buy it for like a, whatever, like $100. You get licensed, which means you filled out all the waivers to compete, and there's a level of insurance that you're given with the racing license that you can compete in sanctioned events by USA Cycling, which is the governing body. So at 14, my dad raced, and then I got into it. Kind of piggybacking off of his stuff that was in the house, and took off from there.
Sure. So 14, that was like what, like 10th grade, 9th, 10th grade?
That would have been summer after 8th grade
Wow.
was the first season, and I was like totally like a dork, like totally didn't know what was cool, what was what. But it's funny because like I'll talk to like people who started around the same time as me, and it's funny like everyone has the same story. Like the mom and dad will say like, "Okay, well, if you want to ride on your own, you can only ride on our street." And then you do your street 100 times, and you're like, "Because you want to ride by yourself, because you can't always ride with like your parent."
Sure.
And then this, or at least how it was for me and
You're
some
just
other
whipping
people
up
I'll
and down
talk to.
Duncan.
So you whip up and down the street, and you're like, "All right, well, I'm gonna do it one block. All right, well, now you're allowed to do the block. Now you're allowed to do the neighborhood. Now you're allowed to do a couple miles." Then, I mean, that's half of the fun. It's like on any given day, it's like I have the fitness and the knowledge. It's like I can go ride to somewhere crazy deep in Kentucky or up there in the boonies of Oregonia, Ohio, and make it back in time for a late lunch. Like it's kind of cool to like see this part, the world that way.
Yeah.
You move too fast in a car, too slow by foot. It's just the right speed. See everything.
That's neat. So how did you get involved with like team cycling? Like when did what were the the wheels that had to go in motion for you to start going just instead of being like Jack McCann, Jack McCann, signed amateur cyclist.
Well, like cycling, like the team thing is kind of like, in a lot of ways, it's just kind of an emulation of the pro thing. Because at the professional level, it is an individual sport carried out by teams, and team tactics are important. But at the beginning, amateur level, there's not a lot of team tactics that happen just because of how the races play out. It's pretty much just comes down to individuals competing. But being part of a team at the amateur level is really important because gives you a group of people to train with and travel to the races with and work together to get sponsorship. So I was super lucky in that a coach that was involved with a local junior team, junior being under 19, knew my dad from when he was racing and knew that I was getting into racing, and he wanted to bring less experienced cyclists into the program so that they can have an opportunity to have the equipment to do really well. And I was involved, so I got involved in this team, like the Pro Chain team, and which still exists. And
Yeah, I like their kits now better than when you were riding for
yeah,
them.
the black and blue ones are pretty sick.
Definitely.
And just having that institution, I mean, that's what's crazy about it, is because when I started, I mean, I would have written myself off. It was just like so dorky, you look bad on the bike, like. But I just wanted to race and I wanted to train, and I guess that was what was more important. But just being lucky enough to have that opportunity and race with some really, really talented guys from when I first started racing. I mean, I don't think really any other mid-American program, not in Colorado or California or the East Coast, has put out as many professionals as our team has, or has many guys who went through the program and really become successful. So I got the opportunity to train with guys who have competed at the world championships, and you know, and other than that, I mean, just having other peers around you to race, like that's it. I mean, that's a huge, huge deal.
I didn't know that. That's really cool.
Yeah. And so, but, and then on the other hand, it's like you have guys who they race and then they go to college and they're like, you know what? I got a lot out of the bike racing experience, but I'm ready to do something else, and that's fine.
Yeah. How many guys, like, I don't know, is it like a sizable enough portion? Maybe, I don't know, not necessarily on a national scale, but like in Ohio, who are both college students and still really competitive? Are you kind of in the minority that you're juggling both?
Yeah, definitely in the minority. I think a lot of people are pretty surprised when I tell them I'm in school full time and racing is at the level I am. I mean, most people expect me to like take a time off or something like that. Because it is hard, but I mean, I don't know. I'm not in too intensive program right now at school, and I'm trained nearly as much at school, but I definitely could more. But yeah, there's, I mean, from what I could think, you know, guys who are in school and racing at the level I do, maybe there's 20 of us.
Wow.
Maybe there's 30 of us.
In like the greater Midwest Ohio thing, or like nationally? Jesus. Wow.
Maybe there's more, and it's there's like a mix, because there's guys who are still in high school or taking a year off and stuff.
Well, that's cool. I think that, not to hype your head any more than it already meets and already is hype, but I think that's really depressed. That like speaks volumes.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
That's cool.
So my racing age is 20, because it's your racing age is the year you turn in the calendar year. So I'm 20, and I think there's like 30-some... registered category one is like the highest level of amateur racing. I think there's like 30, 35 now. Last year there were only like 25, and this is my second year as a cat one in the entire country. Wow. I don't know how many of those guys are in school, and then you know I'm usually ranked somewhere in the middle of all those guys, but yeah, I mean it's obviously a niche sport, but I mean, that level of the racing at this age is like, it's even smaller niche. So when I meet guys at races who are my age, even if they're from somewhere else, it's like, we tend to usually become like pretty friendly just because like, there's like a shared experience there. Like the guys who I knew from racing juniors, a lot of them I still... If I see him at races, always will talk or something, just because like we're going through the same thing.
That's cool. I love the sense of community that stuff like that has. Like even Maine collegiate rugby.
Yeah.
Like we're you know, it's not like I don't want to say we like live and die rugby as a sport in nearly the sense that like cycling is a part of your life.
Right.
Like all the guys who play for Bowdoin, like. No one really played before. Like, it's something they picked up in school. And, like, it's definitely a big part of a lot of our experiences. But, like, it's not, obviously, like, something we've been training at for years. And we're, like, while we are really competitive, we're not competing, I don't think, at, like, a scale that, like, a lot of the people you're talking about, and even you are. But, like, just the community that there is. Like, we're playing guys from, like, University of Maine Farmington who are all, like, presumably, like, Maine locals. And, like, we're all coming from, like, a different background from them. But, like, on the pitch, we're all... in it together, and like after matches, like even if it's like scrappy and like mean on the field, or I guess the pitch, sorry, it's just cool because like we're like we all play Maine college rugby, and that's like a relatively small community.
Yeah, there's an identity to it, and even just right. Like even just collegiate rugby in general, or even just the team, like whatever level you want to take it, that's really cool to have that community feel.
Yeah, and like we're all coming together to do something we enjoy that not everyone's a part of. Like, not everyone really cares about. It's just cool. Like, yeah. We went to this tournament, the Maine Cup, which is, like, an invitational that, like, a team in Portland, like a club, puts together. So it's, like, basically all the college teams from Maine come down and just play a couple of matches and just compete. And, like, it was getting kind of emotional in one of our matches. And, like, We were chirping out there on the field, like saying some things we probably shouldn't have said, doing some scrappy moves that are frowned upon, and so are they, maybe to a greater extent, maybe not. But then, like, afterwards, like, we were all standing around, and it was just nice, like, it's just friendly.
Yeah.
Like, we were just hanging out with the guys. And it was also really powerful because Colby College, which is, like, similar to Bowdoin in a lot of respects, like, small Maine, probably a little larger school, same conference, sort of, like, kind of rivals in a lot of ways, and, like, especially athletically.
Wait,
and
is that where your brother's going?
No, just going to Hamilton, just in New York, but same conference still.
Okay.
But no, like, Colby is, like, pretty heated. Like, the Bowdoin-Colby hockey game is a really big deal as far as, like, school bonding and rivalry and stuff. And it's cool because there's, like, there's a home and away match. So both teams get to have their thing. But rugby is pretty heated as well. And, like, in the time that I've played, we've won both our matches against Colby. And it's always been very exciting. And that's something we take, like, some pride in. But, like, a kid on their team, one of their players, committed suicide. And so it's, like, really kind of, like, even though, like, I don't know the guy personally and, like, I don't think any of us really did, I think it kind of resonated through the team because it was, like, a very similar group of guys had, like, a really shocking experience.
You could, like, see it.
You could see it and, like, you could feel the effects. And then that was, like, maybe, like, a week, 2 weeks before this tournament. And so, like, Colby ultimately didn't end up participating, obviously, because they were, like, kind of mourning the loss of, like, their friend and brother on the pitch. But, like, all the teams in Maine, like, we all came together. And, like, again, like, not everyone really knew this guy, but it was just, like, the sense of community that, like, revolved around
him. You didn't know him, but you knew, like, you didn't know him specifically, but you knew.
Of him, right.
Not even knew of him, but, like, you knew what that person could be. Like, you could fill in yourself at those
Yeah,
shoes.
And it was really wild.
So that's, like, eerie. Yeah.
It was spooky. And then it was just very touching to see everyone, like, share their love and support. Even if we weren't, like, super close to the guy.
I mean, I think that's just a reflection of, like, people want to identify with things. Like, people want to be part of things. And, like, you know, as crazy as rugby is, it's, like, an even crazier and probably in other ways that cycling is, like, people gravitate towards, like, being part of, like, a little tribe and a little community. And, like, that's really important, I think, to, like, how you identify to yourself and is how you identify in a group. And
yeah.
I think that, like, that explains, like, a lot of, like, how people act in the world. And when people talk about this whole, like not to shift gears totally, with, like, the whole Confederate flag thing that's going on, like, that's what that is. It's, like, no. it's that you have a group of people who want to have an identity, and this image is giving them an identity and a feeling and an ethos, and there's a lot of emotion in it, and... You know, I don't think that's, you know, something that people should be identifying with because of it, the connotations, but it's, like, it's completely human. Like, I completely see where these people are
right.
coming from.
You know where they're coming from, even if you don't agree with it. Yeah, that's definitely the case.
And it's, like, there's, like, and I think especially among young people, you know, that guy who you know,
sure,
the Charleston shooter guy. I mean, that guy... He's a young person, and he wanted to cling on to something as an identity and as a mantra and
just like you and
emotion.
I, like, we've got our things.
Yeah,
and then he had his,
and his thing, just, and his thing was, like, full of hate and rage, and, like, and but in, like, and so you look at that and you go, like, oh, that's so, like, disgusting. But it's, like, you could trace how someone's thought process can go to it, and, like, that makes the whole thing seem very much more, like, human and, like, almost a little, like, scary to think, like, how that works on, like, a mass scale, like, with you know, or, you know, even with radical jihadism or anything like that in you know, those in parts of the world where that goes on, it's because you have these young men and women. But these young people who have had their cultural identity ripped away from them because of, like, the history there, and they want to grab onto something, and then you look at this guy in South Carolina, and it's the same thing. It's that he probably felt like his way of life was being threatened, and that's how he viewed the world, and, you know, people are going to defend that, whether or not it's you know, it's completely fabricated in his mind.
Yeah. Jeez.
But people latch on to that stuff, man.
It's spooky.
Yeah.
And it's spooky, but at the same time, you're like, damn, like, if I was, like, coming from a different background and my moral compass was tilted in a different direction, like...
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And that's why I don't think... That's why I don't think this guy is mentally unstable. I think that he just... He took a path that was... That there were probably a lot of warning signs and no one took it out of it. No one pulled him out of that path and he just went on that spiral that way. And it's just scary to think, like,
there's got to be other people like him, you know, like,
yeah, and like how easy that can happen to anyone, and how, and you know, the implications of like how fragile the human condition is, like how this whole thing that we think is like held, you know, there's these solid roads and these government institutions, but like how quickly that could erode away, because it's all in people's heads almost. It's all just people's. The only reason why governments exist is because the people believe that they should in their minds. And, you know, if in this country or any other country, the consensus went another way, then things could change. I guess that's what, yeah, I don't know.
That's deep, bro. You know, everything's in our mind. But no, you're right.
That's like the Bernie Sanders thing. It's like I keep saying the blank thing, but like he's trying to create a campaign based on a movement of a people and people's ideas. And I think that's what's important. It's because, I mean, you know, we were talking about, you know, he's pushing some really noble ideas, and whether or not he's going to succeed with it, just the fact that he's trying to get young people and people in this country to identify with something beneficial to their interests.
I think that's very commendable. That's a lot of his appeal to me. It's like, he's like trying to reach out to me. Like, you know what I mean? Like the fact that like, he's trying to be like very like populist kind of guy and like trying to get like, he's trying to benefit the people. I think that's really impressive.
And I suppose like it's, you know, you talk about enemies. He has these enemies, these corporations. That's who he's putting down. But I guess in a way, those aren't real in the way that like you might have a conservative candidate who like rallies support by getting people to get rallied up about warfare or something completely negative. It's just like he's moving things. He's being positive, and he wants to see this positive change for people. And I think and people hopefully will gravitate towards that rather than, because it's all the same thing. They want to be part of something.
Yeah, it all comes back to that very like tribal mission. Yeah, just like in that Ann Coulter interview, she wants to be a part of like the inner circle of white people who don't want immigrants coming in.
Right.
Like, she identifies with that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
You can trace it all back to just that one, like, nature of people.
Yeah, I mean, I guess identity's been in the news a lot, but it's like, yeah, that's her thing, is that she wants to feel part of something, and she's chosen to feel part of this thing, and she's trying to create an identity that, you know, debatably, you know, like a Caucasian experience doesn't... homogenous Caucasian experience doesn't really exist, but she's trying to make it exist by creating these centrifugal forces of there's us, the white people, and then there's this scourge trying to come into us, and like that's her narrative to create an identity for herself of it being, but it's just one of hate, which is fucked up.
Right. But, yeah. It's you can't knock someone for wanting to create an identity. But, like, you can definitely knock someone for wanting to create an identity that prevents others from expressing their identity. Or, like, I think you can definitely knock someone whose identity is that they're, like, full of hate.
Yeah, it's, like, it's in It's like why is black power not racist and white power is? It's like because black power exists
to like it exists to like promote like
equality
and like recognition of like black people and like creating black culture, whereas white people like or white power is like
wearing a sticker it that exists, says I
it
love
exists
being
as a
white.
Suppression of others,
yeah,
as opposed to like an equalizer,
right? Know? It's yeah, it's yeah. Like you could say I love being Irish, I love being Armenian, I love being Italian, but when you say I love being white, it's like white. The term white only exists in direct contradiction to not being white. It's right. Like to being of color, and like there's no white experience. So like to say that I got into like an argument at school about this. Like this girl was like, you know, my roommate's girlfriend. She was like, I think it's racist that it was. I think it was like Erykah Badu on the Chappelle show performing. She had a button that said "I love being black." She's like, why can't I wear a button that says "I love being white"? Like, she was like, that's racist that she could wear that. And it's like, I don't know. It's like
I think
the institutions of power don't exist for, you know, black women in this country the way they do for white women or white men to express themselves. And I think like I don't know.
Yeah. My mom and I were having a discussion. We were listening to NPR in the car once, and it was like an interview with a lawyer or a representative for this guy who's in prison and has been in like solitary confinement for like 30 years because he was like accused of murdering a prison guard.
Yeah,
and he was like
Angola guy.
What?
He's not okay. Never mind. It was a different guy.
I don't know. Like this, I don't totally remember the details. I was like only kind of half paying attention, but the guy was like. Accused whether or not, I don't know whether or not, you know, it was true. And I think that's like a lot of the debate, but like that he, when he was in prison, like organized black inmates and he was like a Black Panther.
Oh yeah.
And
so
then
the
like
somehow, sex, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I guess so. Anyway, the person who was representing him, whether she was his attorney or just like some like, you know, rights advocate or something, called him a civil servant because of like the organizing that he had done as a Black Panther.
Yeah.
And my mom was like, see, I don't think that's a civil servant because, you know, I don't think the Black Panthers are like a civil servants group. And like, we kind of got into just like started talking about that. And I was like, but I feel like the Black Panthers, like for all they're like, you know, militant, like definitely like they did do criminal actions. They did a lot of good because they like existed to like serve as a voice for like the disenfranchised.
Right,
and they brought like, about like schooling and like they helped promote community. And they also had, you know, like bombs go off and stuff. And
right,
that's
but
good.
that's like the one man's terrorism is another man's freedom fighting.
Right.
It's
right.
That it's like when a group of people has no proper way to express themselves and to protect themselves, like that's the way that it's gonna happen. And, you know, I'm not an advocate of that, but I think that it's there's a much more understandable that it's very understandable how that comes about.
Right, and you look at that, or at least you got to look at that and be like, okay, like, such behavior exists, you know. People in the Gaza Strip are firing rockets into Israel.
Which is, yeah, it's not right.
Yeah, that's not going to happen if people are treated fairly. And, like, no one's just going to, out of ill will, I mean, there are people, but, like, people are gonna do those sort of actions because they feel unjustly treated. We should all take a step back and, like, try and fix that so
yeah.
Those things don't happen, as opposed to just pointing fingers and calling people terrorists and stuff. Not that I'm justifying rocket strikes or like bombings of any nature out of sound.
So in a very interesting conversation I had with my mom, which actually directly relates to you, is I was telling my mom about, we were talking about graduation cheering.
Oh, okay.
And I was saying that when they talk about graduation cheering and it getting out of hand, it's like this very thinly veiled racism,
oh,
and that they're saying these ruckusy black families are coming to our nice ceremony and ruining it with their cheers, and it's just like, and I was like, and my mom and I were talking about it, and she was like, and she, you know, she taught at with her before she taught Walnut, which is, you know, very, very African-American. She was like, I talked to these kids, and it was blowing me away how many of them were first-generation high school graduates.
Right. And that's why, like...
And that's why it's important.
It's, yeah, it's, like, huge for these families to have kids who are graduating from, like, the top-ranked school in Ohio. It's, like, they have every right to celebrate. Whereas, like, with, like, I'm assuming with you and definitely for my family, my parents are like, yeah, you're going to graduate from high school. Like, right. We graduated from high school. You got to just do it. And so it's, like, less of, like, an ecstatic moment. Not to say our parents aren't proud of us. But, like, for them, it's, like, it's very momentous. And, like, maybe these parents don't have this experience. So I think everyone should, yeah, they have the right to celebrate. And then
I was thinking about your thing with the woman who was super mad sitting by you. And then I was talking to my mom with it. I was like, this woman wanted to be mad. This woman knew that this was going to happen, and it offended her for whatever reason. And I highly doubt this woman is racist at all. But I think that she just wanted to be mad about something, and that she got a little kick out of being, I'm the civilized one, and all of you people making a ruckus aren't civilized. It's like, how can you go about your life just wanting to be angry about stuff? And I mean, obviously, like, everyone has moments like that where, like, or like times in their life where, like, everything's annoying them, and it feels kind of good to vent your frustrations at everything. But it's just like
me sitting in that graduation, I could not have cared less that someone across the Cintas Center was going like, like, it didn't stop proceedings. Like, graduation was still, like, an enjoyable experience. Like, it was still meaningful for everyone. And, like, by letting those people cheer, they're getting more out of the ceremony than they would have if they had to be quiet.
Right. And, like, I get it. Like, yeah, you need, like, it's a, my mom's point was that it, like, it sucks if they're calling out names and they call out someone's name who has, like, a bunch of people there, and then they call out the next person's name who doesn't have as many friends and maybe doesn't have as many family members there, and that they don't get as much cheer, and their name gets kind of drowned out from the cheering of the last person. Like, that isn't that great. But I was like, but that's kind of like how the world works. Like, I don't think there's a lot of people who are going to, like, leave it and be like, oh, I'm so mad that the person in front of me got all those cheers, that these people were, I'm so mad that other people were happy for this person and weren't nearly as happy for me.
Yeah, that's just such a spiteful way to live life.
Yeah, and that's how the world is sometimes. And, like, so, like, I'm kind of okay with it. Like, I don't know.
Super okay with it. Like, was I not mad that, like, when they called my name and I walked across that stage that people weren't whooping for me? I was like, yeah, I'm mad. I'm not getting the whoops, but I'm not mad that, you know, X, Y, and Z are.
Yeah.
And, like, at the same time, I'm also not mad that I'm not getting the whoops. Like, I recognize, you know, where it's coming from. I don't know.
There was, like, a Talib Kweli Instagram post, and it was about how this guy got arrested for cheering at his sister's graduation.
What?
And, like, you know, young guy, he's got dreads, but, like, definitely, like, nothing looked like, from what you could tell, that this guy was, like, a nuisance kind of guy. Like, this was not a troublemaker kind of guy.
No, this was someone happy that...
Not to judge anything, but just by looks, this looked like a pretty smart guy. And I guess he cheered something along the lines of, like you did it, baby, or, like congratulations, something. And they arrested him for it. And then, like, the Talib Kweli comment on it was just, like, arresting a black man for cheering at a high school graduation is the equivalent of saying, like, oh, y'all can get your diploma, but you're still an N-word to us. And, like, and it was a knowledge dart, man. It was a real think moment for me, like, why people, or, you know, just how the institutions of power are slanted in such a certain way, I guess. Easy dog, easy puppy.
Not to just completely debase the intellectual grounds of this podcast, but all I could think of when you said there was this Talib Kweli Instagram post, like, why the hell are you following Talib Kweli on Instagram? I feel like he does not have it popping off content. But
I didn't even.
I guess he did.
I got. I don't even follow him. I got, like, retweeted.
Whimsy, bro.
On the TL, bro. It was on the TL.
All right, true. I was gonna say, I feel like some 40-year-old rapper.
I think we've covered some pretty good stuff.
Yeah, I think it was about wrapped up. Put an end on this. Thanks for doing this.